Calling the Customer Service Operations and Safety Committee meeting to order. First of all, the agenda. Are there any additions, corrections, modifications to the agenda? If not, consider that one approved. How about the minutes? Modifications to the minutes. You look like you're still looking. I'll give you a minute. The minutes approved.
One question.
Without objection. Okay, one question.
Well, I'd just like to note that I'd just like to note on the minutes of the, this is the January 10th meeting you're looking at.
Correct.
If you look at the last item, that's the blue line power issues from August. Mm-hmm. In fact, the next to last paragraph. What the paragraph may not fully convey, I'm not asking for it to be amended, but I'm putting it on the record now.
Okay.
That the thrust of my comments was that we had a nice analysis of the technical issues, the things needed for correction of the technical problem that led to those difficulties in August. But what was lacking and what I'm still looking for is an analysis of how communication worked, particularly communication with the passengers. And, you know, we didn't get that kind of thing as part of the follow-up. And that's, to me, the big outstanding kind of blank.
And I believe, Mr. Francis, that's on the agenda for the next meeting?
Yes, that will be on the March agenda.
Is that okay, Mr. Zimmerman?
That's why I'm noting it now. I'm not asking that it be amended.
Okay, so then without
I'll move they be approved as presented.
Second. Any opposition to that?
Just make sure you spell Reagan correctly, yes.
Is there an error?
Mm-hmm. Not essential as far as I
know. Yeah.
We will make that correction.
Okay. Minutes are approved as submitted, with spelling to be corrected if necessary. Action items. Our first one is the Metro Channel. Ms. Beck, or no?
It'll be a joint presentation.
Okay. All right.
Good morning. My name is Sarah Wilson. I'm the Assistant General Manager for Corporate Strategy and Communications, and I'll be joined by Suzanne Peck, who is the Assistant General Manager for IT. And we are delighted to present this this action item for your consideration. This is the first time, I think, that Communications Department has gotten together with IT's expertise to come up with a new generation of customer communications, incident communications, as well as a new revenue opportunity. We've called it the Metro Channel, and it's a series of digital advertising in our rail stations, rolling stock, so buses and trains, and in general in our property. The Metro Channel would be kind of a new generation of communications that would enable us to communicate in real time to our customers, and this is something that we know that our customers have been increasingly demanding as technology evolves and as the need for more robust communications becomes apparent. I'm going to talk about some of the revenue impacts here because communications and advertising is in my shop, and then I'll turn it over to Suzanne to talk a bit more about how it would be rolled out and how the technology would work. Right now, we would be granting a licensee the right to advertise in our system on an exclusive right to advertise in our system through digital advertising, as well as permitting that winning proposer to assume the advertising contract versus static advertising. Currently, we have an advertising contract that brings in excess of $35 million a year. That contract is due to expire in the year 2010, June 30th, 2010. And upon that expiration, the winning proposer would assume that that contract as well. We would consider this a new revenue opportunity for Metro, but at this point we're not, we just don't know whether we'd be able to assume the same amount of revenue that we're currently getting. A lot of that is simply going to depend on what response we get. And as a result, in our drafting of the proposal of the RFP, we're trying to consider a number of different scenarios. And so we have a fairly wide range of estimated revenue, anywhere from $16 million to $178 million over the life of the contract, depending on how much the contractor is willing to provide to us and how much of a capital investment they need to make. And so we're drafting the proposal to be fairly broad. Under no circumstance did we anticipate that the Metro Channel would negatively affect revenues, and instead we're trying to use this as in anticipation of a decreased revenue once that contract drops in the year 2010. And we will be awarding this contract with your approval. We would award the contract on the best and best value basis. So we're considering tons and tons of options. We have a fairly robust model, business model, that we are plugging a number of variables into. And as we receive proposals, we can see how revenue could change based on what we hear from proposals. And with that, I'd like to turn that over to Ms. Peck.
Before you go ahead, Ms. Wilson, or before Ms. Peck goes ahead, can I just make sure that I understand what I thought you said?
Yes.
What I thought you said was we currently have a static advertising. That means the stuff that's on the buses, the stuff that's on the walls, all the other things that we've approved.
Yes.
And you now want to add to that this Channel M proposal.
Yes.
And it is and that would start in 2011. So you're going to have the combination of the two as opposed to either one separately.
That's correct.
And what I thought I heard you say is you don't believe that by adding this, you will in any way negatively impact the static portion of it. You will add some revenue on the dynamic portion, on the Channel M portion.
That is our expectation. Of course, we don't know until we see what kind of proposals that we will get.
Will you advertise in such a way that you can tell the difference?
Yes. We're line iteming every bit of capital investment to see if we, you know, if we didn't require the proposer to make this kind of investment, what kind of revenue could we expect to get? There's, as you know, an inverse proportion between those two.
Okay. So Ms. Peck will then tell us about Channel M. Is that right?
Sure.
Okay. Any other questions before we move forward? Yes. No? Okay. Ms. Peck?
And I'd like to tell you first what I'm going to tell you, and then tell you. I'm going to tell you first that we are not throwing away any of our existing investments when we build Channel M. I'm going to tell you we are not spending dollars that we do not have. I'm going to tell you that we are working small before we work large, and so we will work from pilots forward. And I will tell you that we are supplementing, not replacing. In that mix of declaratives, one of the things that you would surely ask is how does the Metro Channel mate and relate to PIDs? And the two graphics up there are the graphic of our current PIDs and how a PID screen might look under Metro Channel development. PIDs was an investment of about $11 million from about 1994 through 2002, with the last of the PID screens implemented in 2000. So the current screens are about 8 years old as we stand. Yet they still have good service left in them. So for some period of time, the Metro Channel and their screens and the PID screens will coexist. The Metro Channel is going to make those display screens available with much more real estate in a larger format, and it's going to make them available at not only all of our stations and on our platforms. And the minimum that we are asking for responding vendors is that at all entrances and all platforms that those new screens be available, but also on buses and rail cars, at the Metro owned bus shelters, and with displays that we have not previously had before. About 5% of the screens that we're asking for in the RFP will be replacement PID screens. And so 5% of the replacement PID screens will, and essentially the pilots for next generation PIDs that consider all of the ADA requirements, for example, about which we are particularly focused and which the RAC and the E&D committee have particularly focused us, will be built. But the TMC does not provide replacement next generation funding for all of the PID screens, but allows us to do all of the piloting to make all of our to examine all of the possibilities of what PIDs might become. Metro Channel will be delivered throughout the metro system through all 86 stations, and if you look at the numbers 1 through 5 on the screen, it's kind of a walking tour of where those PIDs displays, where you will find those PIDs display. So at the street level, at the mezzanine level, at the outbound track, at the inbound track, and at the street level, PID signs will be available. And they will be available in a variety of standard formats, from a 42-inch screen to a wall screen to a 65-inch stanchion screen or floor-mounted screen. The information will also be available on bus and rail, internal and external, will be available on a variety across the bottom of the page of wireless devices. And the buses and rails can be loaded either statically 3 times a day, can be loaded real-time, or we can have real-time downloads. So what the Metro Channel is going to give us is a standard set of McDonald-type franchise display types that will be customized at each individual station depending on the geography of the particular stations. Metro Channel will deliver, and this is when I said we are supplementing, not replacing, and we're not throwing away any of our existing investment. Today we deliver customer information, incident communications, and advertising. What we are doing is extending all of those. In a normal situation, for example, in terms of customer information, about a third of the screen will be available for customer information. About two-thirds of the screen will be advertising information in a normal situation. As soon as, and it's the graphic that we have here, as soon as there is either an individual location incident or an entire system incident, Metro will take the entire screen, and the entire screen will be given over to incident information, either localized to the particular station or place geography in which the incident is occurring, or system-wide if the incident is occurring system-wide. And our contract will allow us the right to have the entire screen during times of incident. The net cost to Metro is no net cost. Potentially, just because it's easier for us, we may take the power cost rather than charging back the power cost. But even costs like potential vandalism costs to the screen are in the RFP going to be borne by the potential vendor. Historically, both New York and Toronto have found, though, that in terms, just example of vandalism costs, that they have very, very small vandalism costs, less than about $10,000 a year. But even that risk we have put onto the vendor. The first displays are expected by the end of 2010, and the contract would run from the award to June of 2020 with option periods behind. The RFP is for an exclusive advertising partner for at least 10 years with a license to finance, build, maintain, and provide content for the Metro Channel. This contract is going to replace at its natural end the static contract that we have currently with CBS, as Sarah said, and will allow that licensor to give all of the advertising, both static and real-time, in every Metro location or Metro-owned location, only accepting that the contract will not give rights to advertise on the tunnel walls of the Metro system. We are looking for separate proposals, as you see here, to finance the system, to design and build, and to operate, maintain, and sell advertising. All the proposals must be a net zero cost to Metro. And the criteria for success, for being a successful bidder, will be based on technical, financial, as RFPs are, on technical, financial, and creative advertising evaluation. So you must bid on all three. We can choose to take from you one, two, or three, including we can, if we don't get suitable proposals to us, we can maintain the ability to ourselves finance the system. The next steps, let me give out to you, if I may, a letter from the RAC. We have been presented to him what is worse by the Elderly and Disabled Committee on the 4th of February. We presented to and were endorsed by the RAC 2 days later, and the letter that's coming around to you now is the letter from the RAC chairman with the full endorsement and with her and her team's expectation. It was a unanimous endorsement, her and her team's expectations of how we would go forward. We are not being drugged to the RAC or to the E&D committee. We are very, very enthusiastic about their participation, about the all of the ADA, making sure all of the ADA requirements are met, and all of the consumer rider requirements are met as well. So we are very eager to have that input, and we have invitations from both committees to keep returning to them as we develop. So today, we are looking for board approval to initiate and award the RFP and to continue to gather customer feedback. I'd like to take just a few minutes to have Jamie Harvey now show you a demo of the screens and the type of screens that we are looking to build.
Good morning. Give me just a second. So what you see here, this is actually a WMATA advertising cabinet that we took out of the system. And part of the reason that we wanted to show you a sign that's in one of the advertising cabinets, one of the things that we're really enthusiastic about is essentially we've taken one-third of the advertising space and we've turned it into useful space to communicate with our customers and have their rider experience be better. We know, talking to other municipalities, other transit agencies, people like to have a clock on the signs. People like to know where they are. They want to know when they come out that they're which entrance they're at, and they like there to be a naming convention that's out there. So we're going to use this as an opportunity to make that information more available. Let people know as they walk up to a station, hey, these are the lines that are available here. It's red, yellow, and green for Gallery Place. And what's more, before they walk into the system, they're able to look down and say, okay, these are the trains that are coming. Do I have time to get a cup of coffee? Do I have time to stop and chat before I go into the system? So that is one of the features that we are really taking advantage of this revenue opportunity from the advertising to get the upgrade out to the public and make that available. Essentially, the top strip is essentially signage about time and location. This panel over here is used for rider information. This is a sign that we would envision being at a rail station. This is essentially the same information that people get off the PID screens, except that it's in a more user-friendly format. We have real-time weather information. We have a news crawl so that people can know what's going on. And then this space over here is used to deliver content and advertising. So a lot of the time it will be paid advertising, the sort of thing that right now CBS Outdoor sells us for posters, except it will be digital and dynamic. Some of the content will be used to deliver infotainment, so you know where there's a lot of dwell time, where you're waiting for a subway station, people will have some entertainment, they can do look at little quizzes. That'll get them to look at the ads more, it will allow us to make more revenue from the system. There will also be some time set aside for Metro communications. If we want to get safety messages out, if we want to let people know what's going on with Metro, if there's things that are going on at particular stations that we want to let people know, so we can take care of that. The signs are addressable down to the individual sign level. So if you want to get a message out at one station and not at another station, or if there's something you want to get out at this entrance but not at that entrance, we're going to be able to do that. When there are delays, and one of the complaints that we've been listening to our customers, and we've been hearing people want more communication about what's going on. So these signs are going to be all over the place, especially in the busy stations. So we're able to take over this news crawl at will, and instead of giving news, we can give news about Metro. So, you know, escalators are out, there are minor delays on the orange line. we basically light this up red and we let people know, hey, there's something that you should know. And we figure that people will learn, be trained to kind of take advantage of looking at that space. This, by the way, is a sign at another station. This is actually running off College Park main entrance. And by the way, this is the real-time train information. This is really the information that you would see at a PID sign at College Park main entrance right now. If there's a major delay, or there's an emergency, we retain the right in the contract to take over this screen and get messages out to our customers. So, for example, one of the things that we've been hearing is we don't do a very good job of getting bus bridge information out. This would be a very good channel for getting bus bridge information out. So, the yellow and green line are now closed. The red line is still running. We want to continue to give people the information about what's happening with the red line. But we're able to get out, located down to the address that the person is at. Okay, if you're at the 7th Street entrance, you want to go get the information from the buses at these locations. And so we're going to be able to get that out ubiquitously, targeted down to the right area. We're doing a lot of work on the processes that are going to be needed to fix this, because in some ways, the technology is the easy part. The hard part is figuring out who controls this, what the right messages to get out at the right time. And so we're doing a lot of work right now on that. So the sign that you saw was the advertising supported sign. In the contract, we are requiring the offerers to also provide some signs that have no advertising. These are signs that are essentially designed to be easier to read and more sensitive to the needs of our visually impaired customers. So these signs will all be ADA compliant. They will have accommodations for people with different disabilities. And as you can see, it's the same information, except that bigger, more visible, and it's a major improvement over the PID signs because we're able to show all the information at the same time. You know, the complaint that we get about the PID signs is people are looking at the information about the elevator delays, and it switches to information about a disruption, and they didn't get to read where the elevators were going out. And that is a big problem for our customers that annoys them every day. Having a sign like this is going to allow the person to pick which area they read, and it's not going to get interrupted all the time. As Suzanne said, we are not touching any of the PIDS hardware in this contract. We are not taking down any signs. We are only adding signs. But our intention is that we're going to use this sign to get feedback from our customers, refine it, get it to be exactly what they like. And when Metro is ready to do a PIDS upgrade or replacement, we'll have an interface that people already like that we could put up when we do the next PIDS project. So that's my presentation today. Thank you very much for your attention, and we're really looking forward to doing this project.
Ready for questions?
Questions, indeed.
Let me just clarify one of your points there, if I may. You said that this would be done at no cost to Metro. Your expectation, however, is that we would, in fact, make revenue from this.
Right now, we are waiting to see what the RFP brings back to us. We are saying that the successful vendor must cover from the revenues the entire cost of the project, that we will be putting no forward dollars into the project. And we are very hopeful that revenues will still be accruing to us, but we need to wait and see.
Above and beyond the basic cost.
Above and beyond what they need to take to finance this and to build it.
And one other question. If the local jurisdiction bus services or commuter rail services were interested in becoming part of this, is that a possibility?
I think it is a possibility, absolutely.
Could we make that an option in our RFP?
Absolutely.
Okay, and
absolutely.
Mr. Zimmerman had some questions.
I think others do too.
Okay, go ahead.
First, let me commend you. This is an exciting opportunity. I'm glad we have the opportunity to discuss the potential of giving better and more information for our travelers. But I do think, obviously, I think of a lot of our questions are about the details about how this works and how we can benefit from it. One simple question: I saw a movie preview. Sound. Is sound going to be an option, or is it not going to be an option?
Probably the principal concern of the Elderly and Disability Committee was audio. They have made several suggestions to us about how audio could be provided and be provided at no cost to them. They are much less interested, for example, in devices which they would have to carry that would trigger the audio, much more focused on being able to trip audio as they came past the displays themselves. It is going to be one of their principal contributions for us to, as we choose an audio technology, because we really had originally thought not to have audio, and it was because of the E&D committee that we now understand and are very focused on providing audio to these devices.
And the audio may be, you know, we're going to take a look and see what the technologies will offer us. We can, you know, there's a number of options for passengers with hearing impairment. And so we're going to see what the proposers come back to us with before we go committing to assigning what kind of audio, if any, we're going to have.
Well, I raise that question because I'm certain that the board members probably have some thoughts and positions on that issue, and I wanted to make sure we didn't go forward without making sure we have a real thorough discussion about what we want to do as it relates to that. Second question, you mentioned that we were going to start small and kind of before we go big and kind of scale it up. Mm-hmm. Can you describe specifically the pilots that you're thinking about starting with? Give us a sense of what's going to happen first.
As we sit today, we cannot tell you the specific locations, but we can tell you that each pilot will be a jurisdiction, that each jurisdiction will have the same number of pilots, that it will be a combination of your thinking of RAC and E&D's committee thinking and of the vendor as to which the pilot sites are. Understand that we've already had an 18-month pilot that has helped us look at things like rotations and positioning of these and various details of the screens themselves. So we start already from a high place, but the pilots will absolutely be jurisdictionally equivalent and probably geometric. You know, we'll start with three and then in some geometry go to a full set implementation,
so
but always equal.
Okay, equal, and I'd say the same, because I think the sense we'd like to have is the same pilot in different parts of the system so we can get a sense of how people in Virginia react, Maryland, so we have a diversity in terms of inputs and reactions to it. Third question, and really this goes to other benefits that the authority could accrue from having something like this, and I'm thinking a lot about some operational benefits. Is this, the first simple question, is this going to be cable-based or kind of IP, wireless-based information content distribution?
It is going to have both. It is going to require, and we'll speak later today about our new wireline backbone. Metronet is going to require a wireline backbone, and it is going to require a wireless component as well. So both components.
Okay. I'll save my questions about that to the other presentation. I guess I want to just piggyback on the first question about revenue above and beyond what's in the baseline. I know that currently we have a revenue sharing set up with our advertisers. I think it's important we retain something similar to that. If not, we go back and take a look at how we want to make sure it's advantageous to us if things go better than expected and people really do jump on this. So thank you for
Mr. Dean Keller.
Yeah, a series of questions. One, I'd be a little concerned about these being located at ground level or walking level. Certainly, people walking by and damaging it would be a concern of mine. So that's one issue. And the second question is, why so long? We're February 2008. We're talking about implementing or operational in late 2010. This is a public-private partnership. Why would it take so long to do this? And finally, you know, I tell you, I find solitude sometimes is very important on a metro rail. So I'd be a little concerned about the sound issue and the busyness of the display. And that relates kind of to control of the advertising. How do you suspect that would work, or what are you proposing it would work as? You know, how would Metro be able to at least control what's being put on the advertising, or at least monitoring it? And I know we have policy and such, but you know, when you get to the operator, you know, sometimes, and it's not under our control, I'd be a little concerned about that.
If I could answer the last of your questions, and then we'll defer to IT on the other questions. The issue of control over content, we already have processes in place for the board and for us to control that. And so what we would do once we get our proposals back and we decide that how we're going to move forward, we would come back to you for an adjustment to our use regulations. And that would be the board's decision as to how we deal with content and that sort of thing. We've already dealt with that with the web. We've dealt with that in the static advertising. And we would, again, this would be a new kind of forum, and we'd be bringing that back to the board.
Would they be co-located with us at some central location, the people controlling all this?
No. Yeah.
That's not clear until we get the proposal.
The probability is, however, that there will be a control center from which all of this emanates.
Now, how about why so long it takes to implement something like this?
So it's easy to get. When you looked at that slide, you noticed that there was that long 10-year piece of the operating contract. The contract will be in place as soon as the RFP is awarded, and then the build will start. What happens in 2010 is that our contract with CBS Outdoor expires. So the right to sell advertising for the system does not start until that contract ends. So that it will be up before then.
So we can't. Okay.
Yes. Good question.
Ms. Hutchins?
I just wanted to go back and clarify the financial aspect, in that in order for this project to move forward, you need to have a contract in place. And the contract provides all the cost factors that cost the implementation to go forward. And there is no revenue coming from the authority at this point.
The contract requires the successful bidder to completely cover all the costs of implementation and of maintenance. And we are currently requiring either $50 million or the cost of that they think it will take to implement, whichever is larger. If I can, just Mr. Giancola, you spoke to the ground level devices and also to damage. As I say, while we have not had, while other authorities have not had the experience of great damage, these displays are surrounded with a 3/4-inch plexiglass, which can take a direct hit of a baseball bat. It'll take out the plexiglass, but it won't take out the screen. So we're taking out $4 worth of plexiglass, not $5,000 worth of PIDs in general if someone's doing malicious violence to these machines. One of the things that the...
So why don't we put them on our existing signs that are there now?
We do
I could see damage on existing signs.
And the arrangement that we would have with the winning bidder would also be similar to what we have existing right now. We do have from time to time some vandalism of advertising, and that's incumbent on the CBS Outdoor, the contractor, to make those repairs. In some cases, we do have some plastic that's guarding the advertising, but in a lot of cases, they simply have to take down the damaged sign and replace it. And they're pretty good about that. They usually do it within a day or two.
We're putting penalties into the contract for if the signs go down or are damaged and the respondent doesn't take care of them in a prompt fashion, there'll be financial penalties. We think they'll be well incentivized to make sure that the signs are out and not vandalized.
Ms. Wheeler?
Yes. First of all, I wanted to commend you as well. You've heard these comments before from citizens and our riders, and when we traveled the region for our public hearings, I mean, we heard many, many of these comments. So the ideas that you've implemented here, that you're attempting to implement, are very good, but more important, they are responsive, and it really indicates that we have been listening to our riders, and that's imperative. And I think this is a start. Along with some other steps that we have taken, we still have a long way to go, but it's a start in terms of addressing the concerns that our riders have raised, which will give them a much greater comfort level, and particularly coinciding with our fare increases. I think we're doing a long way to justifying, going a long way to justifying our increases. So I do want to commend you on that. And I do want to talk a little bit about the sound component, because I still go back to Disabilities Awareness Day, which was so eye-opening in so many ways. And And I wanted to follow up on Mr. Giancola's comments in that, when he mentioned about the solitude, that's important sometimes, too. But I hadn't really thought of it in that perspective. And I think we just have to find balance. You have to have, you don't want everything screaming at you 24/7. But at the same time, we do have to bear in mind that we have those folks who are sight impaired and have to have the same information that we will be able to glean from, you know, reading these. So I think we just have to balance those two things. And finally, I'm glad to see that even though we won't be fully up and operational till 2010 in terms of the advertising, at least the key Metro information and WMATA information will be available well before then. I just want to make sure I heard that correctly.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Zimmerman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've got a number of questions that fall into three different categories. So let me start with ones that have to do with the operation of this. Since we were just talking about the sound, let me say something about sound first. It's important that we distinguish between things that we need to do to ensure that we meet the needs of all of our customers, including those with particular disabilities, and between things that have to do with the desires of advertisers that aren't necessarily in our interest and may be counter to the good functioning of our system and the peace of our customers as well. So when the last time, which may be 2 years ago now, we talked about new advertising initiatives here, and one of the questions that came up then was advertising, some kind of video screens and how they might be used. The question of sound was raised, and the board was very clear, no sound. A little look at pictures, but not sound. And, the reason was that's the most negative thing we hear from people who, have mixed responses to this in terms of customers themselves. And it's pretty simple. The visual thing may be busy and may bother me, but I can get away from that simply by turning away and not looking at it. The sound is imposed upon them. So, and in a system that already, because by its nature, has noise, we don't need something else competing with it. It's hard enough now to hear the station announcement. So I don't think there's a practical way to include sound in this. And if we need to do something that is, that provides audio for those who specifically need it, then we need to explore all the technological options there. But I don't think we should let the advertisers think that, and I would suggest we not put out the RFP with the idea that you're going to be able to sell the sound. That's the one. Now I have some questions on how this works. So I look at this, and let me say, very exciting. We need more information out there for customers, and this is obviously a vehicle for doing it. I hope we can do it sooner, as Mr. Giancola was saying, rather than later. This is clearly a high-definition screen we're looking at here. Is that what they would be?
Luckily, this is a 65-inch LCD screen,
yeah,
which is likely the form factor that would be used. Plasma screen TVs, they have a less...
Okay, you're going too far.
Sorry.
It's all I need to know.
It's
going to look at least that good?
It'll be at least that good.
Thank you. Can you put it back on?
Yeah,
I'm getting tired of seeing Arnold.
I didn't say that if I have to listen to CNN in one more place, I'm going to scream. I didn't say that.
At least it's Starbucks.
Now, I like the concept of, we let them do some advertising and we get a lot more information than our customers want. And the clock, I agree with the general idea here. I do think the train arrival time looks like it might be a little bit small here. And part of that's a matter of placement. I'm looking at, how far I am. I can read it, but only just. And I was just the eye doctor. My lenses are really good right now. So, I worry a little bit about the ability to see the information you really want to see. And what's relevant here is, how is the RFP being written in a way that will make clear that matters and it's one of the things you will evaluate? Because I can imagine different people making proposals, one of which, I'll pay you more money, but I'm commandeering more of the space for my advertisement, somebody else being willing to take a little bit less. I want revenue from this, but first and foremost, I want good service for the customers. So that's one thing. I hope that the RFP will somehow take into account that as something that the bidders should be designing for. Some of the other screens you showed us were, a little bit clearer. Like I said, that's not bad. That'd be better than having nothing, but I think it might be a little on the small side. Where are these going? Are we talking about Obviously, we're talking about some on the platform level. Are we talking about the mezzanine? Are we talking about outside the station?
The answer is all of the above. De minimis, you must provide at each of the stations, the station entrance and the platform. Then it is a mix and match of standard components in potentially at the mezzanine, at the inbound and outbound tracks, and at other locations as well. Your pitch shows you, for example, a station entrance potential configuration, but the other page that showed you all the possibilities, it's all mix and match of standard components.
People like the PIT system here. It took us a number of years to get it to work and a number of years to get it right in terms of display of information, but people clearly like that. The biggest complaint I get is that there's not enough of it. And especially when you're at some stations like Metro Center, which with very large, you know, platforms with a lot of obstructions and all that, you may have to be way down, you know, one end, and you can't see it from the other end. So placement matters as well. And, you know, if we're going to do this, I hope we manage to put them in enough places, especially at those larger stations, so that, you know, people can see them.
We're looking at between 5 and 11 placements in each station as we stand
good.
Now. Yeah.
That sounds good. All right, so next train info. How about bus? Have we looked at all the application to bus?
The bus applications, absolutely. So we're looking at fleet interiors and exteriors, and we're looking there at either real-time downloads or downloads at the beginning and end of the day, and we will have wireless connectivity to do that sometime in the life of this.
So you're saying both on bus and at bus stops?
Yes.
The ones we own.
I realize there's a place. Is there the potential to expand them if, say, for instance, my county owns a place where there's a bus stop?
Yes.
And we say, hey, we'd like to plug into this. Will we have the ability,
yes,
both technically and contractually, to pop them in?
Technically, we would have to take a peek and make sure that your wireless setup mates to it, but certainly the... Virginia
right, let me just counties. Say, I think that's something that also should be part of the design of the RFP, especially considering the long term of this, so that different places, you know, we're doing something, and if we have a way to plug in and we can put, you know, the equipment there and, you know, pop into the contract and at the bus stops that are controlled by all different kinds of people, not just governments, but private sector and all that, at least it'd be the option then to provide that information.
Mr. Zimmerman, my other role for the authority, in addition to running this project, is I'm the chief enterprise architect. I'm responsible for WMATA's regional architecture. We're building this in an architecture that's going to actually be published as an ITS project, as an intelligent transportation systems project. So this information will be published as web services out to the jurisdictions for them to do what they like. They could put it on signs, they could put it on road signs, they could put it at RITUS.
And you can tap it and feed it.
Yes,
where you
precisely.
Want. Okay, that's good.
And that's being paid for out of the RFP.
All right. And on bus, does that mean we might have the potential where if I'm riding on one bus, I could get information that would be about the connecting information from the train I might be trying to reach?
Absolutely.
You know, I'm headed to Pentagon, and I can get what time the train's departing. All right, I like that too. Let me ask you about the preemption terms. You know, you showed how if there's situations where we need to get an emergency message, basically we can take that over and put it. Now, is that written into the thing, or do you anticipate it being written into the thing? I mean,
yes.
If I paid for advertising, you know, am I getting some kind of compensation, or are there limits to what you can do that? I mean,
Certainly there are going to be limits, and there may be a penalty clause to us that kicks in if we've got it for days on end. But the strategy is that our ownership would take care of any foreseeable normal kind of incident situations and time frames, and that we would not be penalized for taking it over.
Okay. Final set. The term itself is the law. Do you have any hesitation about, I mean, the world's changed pretty quick. We're right now, you know, we're dealing with some things where we were locked into a contract for a long time. Now, you know, the last advertising contract limited us in some ways, but it was good terms, so, you know, we got good money out of it. On the other hand, what we did on cell phones, we've been trying to figure a way around ever since. Are you not concerned about doing something? Does that to your 2020, by which time, you know, if the last time you're in any indication, the world can change five times?
the world will continue to change, and especially when you're dealing with technology, that is a big risk that we're going to be taking here. On the other hand, I think we're trying to be cognizant of what the private sector is going to be interested in and in recouping their capital investment. And the more that we're requiring them to be investing, the more time they're going to need to recoup that investment. So it's a trade-off.
Well, let me ask it a little differently. The last advertising contract, which was a long one, wound up being good for us, not so good for the industry. I mean, they, you know, on their side of things, they committed to a payment to us over a long period of time. We were real happy to lock that in. On the other hand, you know, we're not always smarter than they are. Sometimes it's just a matter of luck. We didn't necessarily know that they were going to be a dot-com bust, and neither did they. What about it goes the other way this time, and 5 years from now, you're saying, gee, we didn't do this on the terms that were the best for us. We do it differently now.
And this is why we're writing the proposal with considering a whole bunch of different variables there. And what we will do is mixing and matching of what we get back from the proposals and putting it into a pretty robust business model and then making that analysis at that point. But you're right, it's a risk that we're going to take. There's imperfect information, but we're going to make the best decision that we can based on whatever information
we've
got.
Well, I mean, one way is you could share the risk. You could write the thing so that it doesn't lock in the price for that whole term, but says, you know, that there's something that would vary. So
that would be a decision for the board.
All right, finally, when the board initially did this work on basically approved the new advertising initiative, looking at things like this, one of the things we included was that the revenues that would come from them would be going to identified customer service improvements, and that they would be named later, but that they were going to be targeted for that. So any of the additional advertising that people were, you know, putting up with would be going to improve their experience. And the first thing I think we did with it was the restoration of the trash cans into the stations, when we had to get the new, you know, bomb-resistant ones or whatever. So how are you going to show that? Maybe I should be asking Mr. Cato this, but, you know, how are you going to tie this and, you know, this new area we're opening up? Now, in one way, obviously, it's providing that benefit. I understand that. But, you know, there is a flow of revenue here, and, we're going to see that, and we're going to be able to show customers that what they're getting for it, as opposed to it just sort of disappearing into the budget. Because as much money as we talk about here, it's a tiny little fraction of the metro budget.
Well, we need to show a line item connection. If we receive X dollars, say $10 million, and let's pull that number out of the air, then what do we spend that $10 million on? We need to show that it was some enhancement to what the customers. And that could cover a wide variety of things, new information signs, new ways, new processes of doing things. And in some cases, it might be service enhancements, but they have to be very specifically tied up.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr.
Chairman. Mr. Monahan, followed by Mr. Graham.
It's a follow-up to a comment.
But as we do continue, let me just note the fact that we are on our first agenda item of a long agenda, followed by another committee with an even longer agenda.
We have 10 action
agenda
items.
Okay.
This one's more fun.
There you go. And I think my comment question is really tied to Mr. Zimmerman's comments about the long-term nature of the contract and really making sure we build potentially some sort of ramps for both parties to either exit the agreement or to essentially hit reset and renegotiate the agreement. I think that's part of the risk-sharing component. We can put some off-ramps, say, at 5 years or 3 years, where we have the ability to either swerve or to kind of reconsider the proposition.
We also have built, as we previously mentioned, right into the contract, the VRP as it goes out, the ability to ourselves, just as Mr. Zimmerman says, to share the risk also by taking on part of the financing ourselves, by taking on part of the operation and maintenance ourselves. If the bids come back and are not rational business bids from our perspective in terms of what we get out of it in terms of the revenues.
The way the business model works, essentially, it takes a while for the revenue for this to ramp up for the offeror. So to a certain extent, the market feedback we've gotten was that the contract must be at least 10 years long. Some of them have come back and said, let's make it 15, let's make it 20. Looking at other municipalities and other transit agencies that have done this, the shortest contract we've been able to find of this sort was 8 years. We are building the RFP, asking the respondents to tell us what the revenue streams are like at different terms. And what they told us is the longer the term is, the the more revenue they're going to pay back to us, the higher the guarantees will be. If you want us to, we could also do lower years, where we said, okay, if it was 5 years, what would it be? But there's some point at which, if they get short enough, they're going to say, it's not worth us doing it.
Mr. Graham?
Yeah, I don't think I'm going to be able to support this today. And the reason is, and maybe if I hadn't seen this video over and over and over again, I might be reacting differently. But what I'm seeing is skulls, people's heads going through glass, violence, sex. And this is the type of video that I think most people would not find controversial in America 2008. But it was just today or yesterday that I saw from the general counsel a note on a potentially controversial ad which had some absolutely horrible thing about the sector of transportation. And having been through this whole content issue, and you know what I'm talking about, Mr. Zimmer, having been through this whole content issue, not only, by the way, I won't go into ancient history, but not only as a member of this board, but when I was executive director of Whitman Walker, and in the mid-80s we fought to be able to mention condoms, but you know, for 20 years I've now been through this content issue. And now to take this whole issue with all of its controversy, all of its problems, and give it an enormous video screen, do you know what I'm saying? It just seems to me to escalate the problem that we're having. And you know, and I don't know, I'm far less troubled with the noise, although I understand the point that you're making about how that captures people, than I am about how we will have no control over this content to speak of. We will, as long as they're paying for the advertising, you know, we're going to be faced with all manner, and I could give you chapter and verse on examples just in the past several years. And so we're taking something that today appears in print, and I'm not sure I have the vocabulary at my command to capture the difference between something that is a poster and something that is this. And having watched this now for I don't know how many minutes, and seeing the head go through the windshield over and over and over again, and the skulls and everything else, you know, is this, you know, and I know I'm, this is kind of like, visions of, you know, Cletus Barnett. Some of you may remember Cletus Barnett, who really saw Metro, and I'm going to summon up his memory for a moment, if I may. What was that?
Sam.
It was a
which is the one trouble.
The Maryland people will appreciate this. Because Cletus saw the Metro station is a kind of an urban cathedral, you know, that was constructed in a way where you walked into with a sense of awe and appreciation and solitude and silence, except for the roar of the train when it arrived. You know, and we have now, you know, we're galloping, you know, away from that. And so I'm uneasy about this, and I'm uneasy about what we're going to broadcast. And for those of you who don't know this, I think there may only be one or two, but we have major and I'm an attorney, we have major constitutional issues relating to content of advertising. And even if we could restrain the two Catholic bishops kissing and all of that kind of stuff, you know, you're still going to be left with the things that we now are just absorbing, such as what we've seen for the last 20 years. And I have really real issues associated with this.
Ms. Hutchins.
You know, I appreciate the purity of the system as it was designed. And I think we had a great review of that a couple of weeks ago of just how perfect the system was to be in order to serve this region. But I think we started out talking about, is it 36 million yearly from the static advertising? And I don't think we went there because we were trying to make the system just as pure and inviting and comfortable and attractive as well as a delivery. We got there because we needed revenue. And if I recall, we understand that it is the one revenue source that is the least cost impact that we can depend upon. I wish I could think of a better way to fill those holes, but I don't think we've gotten there, particularly when the next discussion we'll have in subsequent meetings will be what will be the cost borne by the customers and what will be the cost borne by the jurisdictions and where the absence of the cost and other partners that we have. So I empathize with the the view that you have there about what might we put up with, and having recognized that once the authority defined that they would go into the venue of advertising, what we are compelled to deal with on the issue of speech and the like, I don't know what else we might do. We could choose not to do any advertising, and that could address a whole other issue that we have. But I really appreciate your comments, but it's really kind of off. It's seemingly we've started a pathway that we recognize that that's a revenue source that we were asked in the public hearings. You know, what else are you doing in order to bring revenue to the table for?
And Ms. Hudgens and Mr. Grimm, if I may, there will be another opportunity when we have a discussion about modifying the use regulations, which will be subsequent to this discussion, about what we are going to permit, what the forum will consider, and that's going to be a discussion with council as well. We've already had some of that discussion as we talk about advertising in a whole bunch of different places, and as technology evolves, we're going to continue to be coming back to the board for your policy guidance on how we ought to treat the different fora as the technology evolves.
That's the basis on which I voted in favor of the last advertising. But this seems to be a very substantial escalation of all of that.
Mr. Zimmerman.
I'm not sure you're just uncomfortable with the Republican governor of California being shown over. I believe that was the only thing you made.
Other than that,
surfboard.
Well, that sucks.
Mrs. Hudgens is right that, you know, number one, it's a question of do we need to go this way for revenue, and we sort of, the system made that decision in the beginning. There is a question of how far you go, how fast, how much you do, and that's a fair one. There are a lot of things that we've tried, and, you know, I don't like some of them. You know, I don't think fully wrapping a bus is a good idea. I think more advertising on bus is okay up to a point, but I need to know it's the bus, and I need to know what bus it is. I don't know how I feel entirely. I thought that wrapping the trains was less objectionable because at least there's no ambiguity there. On the other hand, I'll confess, I don't particularly like seeing our trains wrapped. But, you know, somehow we have to find what the combination of things are that yields a reasonable amount of revenue to both give the revenue that we need for the improvements we need for the customers and demonstrate that, in fact, we are trying to get a revenue every way we can because the customers and the governments that support us want to know that we're doing those things. But also, there are some things that provide benefits. And, you know, this is at least one way we're going to get something out of it. The customer's going to get something out of it if it's useful. And I'd say that I appreciate the difference that Mr. Grimm is trying to get at, that the moving visual, you know, is more, you know, it grabs hold of you much more. That's why people want to pay for it. Mm-hmm. And I certainly appreciate the commitment to that. I'd also submit that long before the end of the term of this contract we're talking about, these things are going to be everywhere. You know, anything you're going to be seeing in our system, you're going to be seeing above ground all over the place because this is where things are going. And so to not find a way to take advantage of it for the benefit of our customer, I think would be a mistake. Nonetheless, the kind of cautions that Mr. Grimm is making are valid, and the comments Ms. Wilson made about that are relevant, that you know, how we adopt guidelines with the appropriate, you know, councils that, you know, we can do this, what we can do legally, is going to be very important. And I think that we ought to be able to see what, this is an RFP, we ought to be able to see what it is that comes back and how we are able to control various aspects of this before we commit to it. Therefore, Mr. Chairman, I move that the committee request board approval for the initiation of a contract such as described in this and with the caveats expressed by the committee here, subject to a contract being brought back subsequently for final approval by the board.
There's a motion and a second. All in favor?
Mr. Chairman, yes, I just want to say I'm going to be voting no. And the reason I'm going to be voting no is that this is too much of an escalation for me.
And I think there's something happening here. I'm willing to support the other advertiser. I'm not troubled by the wraparound buses or cars. But I think this carries us too far and is too problematic at this point.
Just an RFP, you'll get a second shot.
I understand. But I don't think we should waste anybody's time. But I'm not in the majority.
With the committee's permission, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Okay, please record that. And we really do need to move on.
Yes, sir.
Thank you for offering your
Okay, Mr. Kubitschek, are you going to need to do this whole presentation, or can we summarize it quickly and move on, because we're really running out of time?
I could summarize it very quickly. We really need this piece of equipment.
It saves money and it's in the budget, right?
Yes.
Yeah. It is not in the budget. It is not in the budget. Okay.
It's within the capital program.
No, it's not within the capital program. Mr. Kubitschek is proposing to move things that are currently in the program out of the program.
Is he going to replace it?
Okay. So it will not increase the cost. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay.
You handled it very well.
Okay. Mr. Hughes, before you start, does the committee wish to hear this whole presentation?
No.
Do you want a short version or do you want to vote?
Short version.
So, Chairman, I move approval.
Okay. I have a motion on and
a second.
And a second. Mr. Graham, do you really need to hear it, or shall we
move
ahead?
Let's go.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. We have disposed of our action items. Thank you. That was an excellent presentation. You knew when to stop. This is really the trick. Mr. Francis?
Are you going to ask the same question?
Good try. Good try.
You can give us a very quick summary. You know, this is...
Okay. I'll make a brief presentation on our December operations performance. In the last committee meeting, you know, we heard words such as accountability, high standards, and continuous improvement to reach our goal of providing service to our customers, reliability, and customer satisfaction. Our December on-time performance is the best it's been since July at 91%. As I mentioned before in the last meeting, that we have been and will continue to improve looking at our on-time performance, our schedules, our maintenance, our vehicle reliability on a day-to-day basis. In the next couple of pages that you can see in your handout, I think it's all the way through to page 52, what I did was just summarize. We have been taking a look at our performance on a daily basis. The committee asked me last time to break down how the red line on-time performance, yellow, and so forth. So we did that, and I put that in your packages. But I wanted to jump right quick. We have talked about operations. We talked about maintenance as far as cleaning the system, the preventative wayside maintenance. But I just want to give you a snapshot. This is what I call the master picture. Each day we take a look at our series of cars, as you see below, the 1,000 series. We see the 2, 3, and the 4,000 series cars. But this is what we capture every day. It's a comparison. I should say it says comparison by failures, but it's also by faults. And I want to make something clear now that what you see there is, for example, you'll see that the highest number of what we call failures or faults are the propulsion system in the vehicles. But I want to make something clear that does not shut down or have anything to do, or some of it does not have anything to do with our service reliability. And what I mean using that for an example, you may be in your car, and what happens sometime, you have a check light that comes on or a system light, but you can still operate your vehicle. Sometimes what happens in our cars are the same thing. They may have what's called a propulsion fault, but we can still move. But I wanted to show you that because that's what the vehicle maintenance personnel are capturing every day. And we're using that to monitor each series of cars. Any questions on... Okay.
I do.
Yeah, okay. I have a couple questions. It looks like we're not doing as well on the green line. What was the reason for that drop in from last month to this month?
On the Green Line in December, we had about close to almost an hour delay. We had a vehicle that came in contact, or we had a customer come in contact with one of our vehicles on the Green Line, and that delayed the system for almost about an hour.
So the one incident resulted in that drop?
It resulted in about an hour delay. So when you did that, everything kind of back, you know, shut the system really down from a reliability standpoint, so it backs everything up.
But the one incident created the drop.
Well, that was the biggest. And then we had a couple of incidents that what we call brakes in emergency, where we had our trains experience a brake problem, and that caused a couple of delays, too.
Okay, second question has to do with elevator availability. I noticed that dropped as well. I thought we were rehabbing all our elevators.
Well, what happened was the elevator, yes, you're right. The availability dropped in the month of December. We almost had six elevators that we were rehabbing at one time, and that dropped the figure down. But in January, three of those came off, I should say.
So what is the future schedule for the elevators being taken out of service for rehab?
Normally, I think we're averaging about three elevators per month. You know, in that particular month, you know, we end up having almost twice as many, and that's what lowered the reliability.
And are you anticipating that in the next couple months? Or, I mean, what's the
projection? No. We are figuring to catch up with our rehab to have at least around 3 to 4 a month.
All right.
Mr. Monome asked in the last meeting about our mean distance between failures on our bus system. I'm happy to report that due to our capital investment, our life of our buses are down from about 10 years, about 7 years, and you can see the mean miles between failure has increased about 7,600. And what I want to provide to the committee next time, too, is, and I think this was asked by Mr. Monome as well, as the type of buses and what their performance are, clean diesel, CNG, hybrids, and so forth. So I'll have that for you the next meeting.
I should have a similar question for the rail cars. The slide right before that rail car fleet comparison by failures, it'd be useful to also see the number, because we have percentages here, and I guess I could do the math, but I'm not going to do that real quickly. But get a sense of just the number.
I have that.
Oh, you do have that?
I can, yes.
Okay,
I didn't want to disburden you with a lot of...
The number of cars or the number of failures?
The number of failures by fleet, so we have a sense, you know, where we should...
That's actually my fault. They originally had the number for each fleet in the grand total.
Oh, you did.
And I said the problem is that you get a really large number for... On certain fleets,
exactly.
But that's because they have an awful lot of cars.
Right.
So this at least gives you the relative number, and so
Understood.
You do have the number of cars there, so you can do it real quickly. But
I guess I just want to
show up one way or the other.
I want to get a sense of, we've done rehabs in some of the much older fleets, and we're kind of transitioning into newer fleets with the 6,000s and the potentially the 7,000s. Are we having a lot of trouble with the 4,000 and 5,000 series cars? I mean, that's what. It kind of seems like.
Yes, the 4,000 series fleet has a DC propulsion. It's really the most dated propulsion system that is out there. If we were to go out to try to buy that propulsion system today, they don't make it anymore. So as we are approaching its midlife overhaul process within the next 3 to 4 years, as we come back with our capital suggestions, that would be one of the fleets that would be targeted to be upgraded, like what we're going through with the 2 and the 3K.
So what does that mean on a day-to-day basis, I guess? What does that mean that when we have failures on those cars, it takes more time to get them back in service because we have to find the parts?
Due to the age of the fleet, they are prone to be less reliable. That's part of the reason why we are tracking these on an incident-by-incident basis, trying to get develop trends to be more proactive with the equipment that we have to operate every day.
But know that there are only 100 of them.
Right, small bit.
So, Mr. Francis, you don't get to win either way, no matter which way you're provided. Somebody tells you to do a sale. Any other questions?
Just a question about the Metro Access performance piece. And you're showing at that first chart, you have the performance based on, the number of increased riders, but also the on-time piece.
This is almost similar to what we talked about last month, is that the ridership growth is going up, and we have to rely on other services to support that, such as our taxi cab service.
Can we move on to the next item? Okay, let's move on to the next item. Mr. Hughes, you get to do it this time. Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning, sir. This is a presentation I do think we need to see, but I think you're going to try and move quickly, right?
Yes, sir.
If that's possible.
Absolutely. I'm coming. John, you going to put up for me? Thank you. Just so we can start. I'm here today to brief the board. This is an information item. And we want to start a public involvement process. So before we did that, we wanted to brief the board so everybody was on the same page. Next one, John. What we're proposing is a blue line realignment, and the reason that we're doing this is threefold. And I'll go through them in detail. I'm pulling Suzanne here. First, I'm going to tell you what we're going to tell you. There has been more growth in the eastern portion of downtown. The railway liability on the portal, this will improve this on the Roslyn portal. And also we will be able to utilize the available unused capacity on the Yellow Line bridge. So that's why we want to do it. Let me go through them individually. Sorry, I added a slide since the mail out. What does this do for us? This is an advantage, I think, for us, Metro, as we operate our service and for our customers. There are a number of benefits, and I'll say them up front, we'll go through them again. I think it better tailors our service to the ridership patterns. As our ridership pattern changes, we would have the ability, with your approval, to sort of modify the service. It will increase capacity to get more Virginians across to the district from both the tunnel and the bridge. And people coming from the southern portion of our region in Virginia can get a savings by this, depending upon where they're going, as much as 12 minutes. Does improve reliability, which is one of our key goals for the next couple of years. We're going to be able to do this without asking for any more costs. Is that a question?
I do. I'll let you finish this part first.
Okay. And it does provide a direct service during the peak periods from the Franconi-Springfield area all the way up to Greenville.
Okay. So my question is, because the blue line goes to Largo Town Center and Morgan Boulevard, and I'm hearing the benefits to Virginia. What are the benefits out there?
The benefits on the blue line, the way we're going to do this, and I'll explain it later, is we're not taking anything away from Largo. So from a Largo perspective, from the blue line gets the exact same service it gets today. So we're not taking anything away. From a Maryland,
taking, there's no benefit. Okay.
There's
okay.
No benefit.
Okay.
The benefit really comes from it opens up a new market that we have in the off-peak, okay, which comes from the upper portion of Prince George's County and from Montgomery County down to the blue line, the southern portion of blue and yellow line.
But I, gonna go into?
Actually, I'm going to follow that up and get to your diagram.
Okay.
Thank you. Back to this chart, Uncle Ball numbers, shows our downtown stations and where the growth has been in the last 5 years. And the growth on the eastern portion of the service is on the eastern portion of downtown is about a 15% growth. The growth on the western portion of traditional downtown is about an 8%. Numbers are still bigger on the traditional employment, but the growth change is happening. And my quote is, that's where all the cranes have been for the last 5 years. On the eastern portion and all the development that's happened, whether it's employment or whether it's housing, that's where the development has happened. We've seen that from our ridership trends. These are our riders that we count going across between the Blue Line and Roslyn. Go on, John. Between the Blue Line ridership, between Roslyn and Foggy Bottom, and also between the Yellow Line, between Pentagon and Lafont. We've seen a growth on one side. We've actually seen a decline on the other side. What we also want to do, in addition to responding to the need of where people are going, is improve our reliability. Presently, we're running 26 trains through the Roslyn portal, 16 orange line trains and 10 blue line trains. That's our max. We've come to our board and we said we've done our analysis of train every 135 seconds, equals 26 and a half trains an hour. What really happens when we bump up above that is every time we have a delay, it takes a long time for recovery. Door problem, a sick customer, it takes a long time to recover. And so we want to improve that. I'm going to go through the proposal. John, would you put the map up? John, behind me? Okay. I'll use the words and do it from the map at the same time. As soon as the map comes up.
Is the screen behind
me? I can't do that, and that's very distracting. Personal opinion. I'm waiting. Okay, presently, you've got it in front of you. I'm going to start to describe the map, if I can. Current service. I'm going to start from the bottom to show you what I tried to show. The map. We have 10 trains an hour that start at Franconia on Springfield, the blue line down here, and we have 10 trains an hour every 6 minutes that start from the yellow line. Sorry. When they get to the Pentagon, they split back up. 10 trains go this way, 10 trains go this way. The blue line then merges with the orange line train, and so on. I'm not going to go through all of this. That's the arrows. Those are the numbers. That's the present service that we have today. You know, the yellow line merges with the 12 trains an hour we have in coming up to the Reba. So our downtown areas, we have between Rockford and D&D Junction where they split again, or Stadium Armory Station where they split again, we're running 26 trains an hour in that direction. Up on the green-yellow line between LaFont and Mount Vernon, when we turn yellow lines, we're running 2 trains an hour. We're maxed out on the Rollinson portal, and we have more capacity coming in from the south that we're not using. Potential for more capacity.
Mr. Hughes.
That's the present.
What is the max capacity for that yellow line up to? Because right now you showed 10 coming across the bridge, and then you showed 22 from the west, but from the south, what's the max?
We have 10 there,
12
there, 22. The max is 26.
Max is 26.
The max anywhere is 26. Okay. Max is 26. Yeah. We'll get there. Now, what are we proposing? Got the new one up there? I get this again. I'm from the south. Franconia Springfield, same train trip, station train is there every 6 minutes. What we're proposing when it gets to Pentagon is that some of them, four of them, been out there, will now utilize the yellow line bridge, all through the downtown, all the way up to Greenbelt. Greenbelt because it gives an opportunity for another market, and Greenbelt because that's where we turn trains around during the peak period, the terminal station. That reduces the number of trains that are going around the blue line. So there will be less of those. It gives us the ability to have more trains coming in through the Roslyn, same number of trains through the Roslyn, but more trains coming in off the orange line. So same number of trains, but all over the place, different locations, service markets, and increases compatibility over here. As we take these four trains off the blue line, I would create sort of holes in the schedule from Largo. Instead of having a train that would come out there and turn around every 6 minutes, there would be a hole because the train went the other way. So what we're proposing to do to replace that is we've got all these trains coming on the orange line. The vast majority of them go to Carrollton Station to pull in and sit there. So we can run them back and forth and keep the same headway. If you got on a train to Largo today, it's every 6 minutes. In the future, it would be every 6 minutes and bring them downtown. The only difference is if you wanted to go to National Airport, for instance, you would have to wait for maybe every other train or one out of every three trains, depending upon the list. But from the frequency of the vast majority of the riders who are commuters, again, during the rush hour, when we're closing this, they're coming to and through the downtown. And so they would be able to maintain the same level of service that they have today. That's our proposal.
Before you go any further, let's go back to the picture. Just so that we understand what's going on here. If I get on a train at Franconia Springfield now, or in the proposal as compared to today, that train may end up either at Largo or at Greenbelt.
That's correct.
So for the first time, I'm getting on a train where the destination point is on a different line. Right now, I can have multiple destinations, but they're always on the same line.
That's correct. Except for like
okay, go ahead. Go ahead.
I trust you. Is along between King Street and Pentagon, as they go to the station now, they must know which train they're going on. It's a destination in the color. It's different. It's a different communication to the customer. But they
they do have choices along that. What we're doing now is opening up that choice for Van Dorn and Franconia.
I understand, but it's for the first time that you are actually on a train where the destination is on a different line in that section. Now, let me ask the other. There's another. Yeah, right. Except for the 4th of July. The same thing happens on the Orange Line, right? I can get on an Orange Line train now, or under this proposal in Vienna, that will in fact end up at Largo.
That's correct.
So I have two places where trains are doing something very different from what they used to do, which means that our communication with our customers becomes much more complex. It also says that you not only have to be doing some investigations when you talk to people in Virginia, but some in Maryland too. It seems to me that a great deal of attention has got to go into how we designate those trains. Do we create another color line? Do we call those yellow line trains that are operating out of Franconia Springfield and blue line trains that are running out of Vienna? And what do we do with maps, and what does it cost us to do all of this?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I think those are very good points, and it seems to me like now we're showing this as blue line going somewhere else. The one thing I'm sure of is that it doesn't make any sense to call that a blue line. It would make more sense to call it a yellow line train that has a different destination at the end. But, you know, that's one of the things they need to work on. However, in terms of complexity, I mean, let's keep in mind that while that might be a new thing if you're standing at Franconia, it's not a new thing when you're going the other direction and you're standing at the platform at, you know, say, Farragut West. Mm-hmm. Because now, you know, when I'm there, if I'm going to my office, I need to make sure I get on the Orange Line train, not the Blue Line train. And if I'm going home, I may be saying I need the Blue Line train to make sure I don't get on the Orange Line train. You know, so some of this is just, you know, part of what it is with a complex rail system. Our system would become somewhat more complex, but of course, that's the immediate trade-off with choices. So now, standing at Franconia Springfield, I'd have destinations available to me that I didn't have before. If I wanted, if I have a flight at BWI now, and I'm thinking, gee, I'd like to go to Greenbelt and get that 30B bus, is it D30 bus? You know, it's fairly complicated for me to get there. Now, with this thing, I'd have a direct route there. On the other hand, I have to make sure I get on the right train. I mean, that's just inevitably.
I don't disagree. What, I guess one of the things I'm saying is communications is a major issue here. And one of the things we need to explore as we do what you're proposing is to talk to customers about what the least confusing way of doing something like this is.
Great.
You know, is it another color? Is it relabeling? Is it making, you know, causing the yellow line to go from Franconia Springfield as we do it on our drawings? Is it putting a blue line that goes all the way out to Vienna? You know, I don't know. But that needs to be thought through very carefully, or we're going to have a lot of very confused customers going to the wrong place.
I want to follow up on the capacity question that I started off with about 26 per portal being the maximum we can fit through. And so what I'm looking at, and you mentioned something about the number of cranes and the need and the demand kind of driving what we're focused on. I can share with you right now, Mayor Fenty's at Anacostia Poplar Point this morning, right now announcing the developer for the Poplar Point area of D.C. And I'm thinking about if we're bringing all those new development, all those new employees, all those new residents to that part of the city, and what I'm seeing now is basically we've maximized the capacity on essentially every portal except for the one that heads out to Largo. What are we going to do to address the increased development in Anacostia and that side of, frankly, of the county and the city if we've essentially maxed out the capacity of both those quarters coming in? So I think we need to be mindful that we're doing something that's a good thing, but are we completely eliminating our capacity to absorb growth where growth is happening?
Try to answer that without getting too technical. As we put our plan together, and as we dealt with where we want to be in the next 15 years and where the riders are coming up, we've used every municipality's developmental plan. It goes to COG. We get the models out of that. So we've got built into there all the development that's proposed for Anacostia. That's development that's all proposed for Prince George's County. As we submitted to them our plan about how we were going to serve that with capacity, this plan serves that capacity. I'm only talking about the number of trains through here. We've also proposing to go up on 8-car trains. So as we go up from, you know, 15% 8-car trains up to 33%, up to 50%, up to 100% 8-car trains, that's where the capacity comes to get the development that's programmed between now and 2025. I'm sorry, that's a little technical. But I'm trying. If I can, should I go on?
Move on.
Thank you. Benefits. sit back down.
Impact on the customers. There are pros and cons. You've brought some of them up yourselves, but we do think it's a better service, better tailored to the ridership patterns. The Virginians, the riders from the south will get more service the eastern portion of downtown. There are four additional Orange Line trains coming in from West Falls Church. It's more reliable service. Travel times for about 7,000 riders will actually be reduced somewhere between 2 and 12 minutes.
We could
17,000. Did I say something different?
You said seven.
I apologize. No added cost for service in this. We built it into our plans. A car mile is a cost of a car mile, no matter where we run the trains. Direct service is provided from Franconia, Springfield to Greenbelt. There are negatives. There is the Blue Line's riders that are going around the Foggy Bottom rider on Roslyn will have a longer commute. They will wait longer between trains, up to 12 minutes. About 13,000 of those riders. And as mentioned earlier, is in all of them, is how do we explain this to our customers? What we want to do, and what I'm briefing you on, is we want to go out and get feedback from our riders. So we want to go to the RAC. We're going to go to the JCC and make a formal presentation, get everybody to understand what we're doing. We want to go out and interview customers. We want to go out and interview stakeholders. And so we want this process over the next couple months to become public, and you all hear comments about it. So that is why we wanted to brief you today. And so for the next steps is we think that this will take about 3 months to get public input, a little bit of time to regroup and see what we're doing and come back to you before we get a final plan. Based on all this, what we're gearing for is trying to be able to do this by the time all of the 6,000 series cars are here and ready for service by the end of this calendar year. So there's a lot of work that's got to be done. We want to start the process.
Mr. Chairman, it's clear this is something that is a work in progress, and I think that one thing people should take away from this is that, you know, we're not being presented with a fait accompli. We're being presented with something that's being worked on that, you know, is we're going to be taking into that the staff's going to take input from and going to continue to refine before something is done in any way permanently. I think that's important. There's one overriding consideration when you can measure things a lot of different ways and the trade-off between, you know, more options and some people's ride may get shorter and some people's ride may not and, you know, all that sort of thing. The overriding fact that I think needs to be borne in mind is that in our system, which is obviously straining for capacity, we have, you know, I know it's all over the system, but our Northern Virginia riders especially talk to us all the time about Orange Crush and on the Blue and Yellow Line about the similar kinds of problems and why we don't have, you know, more trains and all that. The fact of the matter is we have limited capacity on the from Virginia across the river to D.C. and Maryland in either direction. We are constrained by the fact that there are exactly two ways to get over the river in our system. That's all there is, and nobody is planning to give us a new bridge or a new tunnel anytime soon. Right now, we are not using all the capacity to cross the river. We are fully utilizing the capacity of the tunnel that is referred to here as the Roslyn Portal. But on the bridge, we're not using all the capacity. And ideally, we could put even more trains on the bridge, but because of limitations, because you have to share the L'Enfant portal with the Green Line, the best we can do is add four more trains. That is, however, four more trains in a peak hour is about an 11% increase in train capacity across the river. So, you know, when we're talking about all the things we need to do, here's something that can be done with the existing infrastructure that is already built, and you get 11% increase in capacity right away. Now, you're going to be adding cars to all of these all three of these lines over the next year. I don't know how many that amounts to, but do you know how many that will be going to Orange, Blue, and Yellow?
We do not have them by line, but we still have about, we're going to increase our peak requirement by about 80 more cars between now and the end of the year.
In any case, when you add that to it, what we're saying is that perhaps within 12 months, we could be adding somewhere between, I don't know, 11, 12, 15%, something like that. I mean, I'd like you to get the number. But we're talking about a pretty significant increase in the capacity to move people between one side of the Potomac River and the other. And so there's whatever we do, I don't think there's any way we can not use that capacity. And any way we do will involve complications such as these, and we'll have to deal with them. But it's capacity that we've got to have. Now, long term, it just points to the need to overlay this system with other ways to move people around. And the other things we're doing, such as the district streetcar effort, similar thing we're doing on our end, and improvements in bus service. One of the things I'd specifically like you to look at is for those passengers who manifestly will not be advantaged by this, and who could have a longer wait. And those are basically people who are going to the west from the south. If your destination is Roslyn, you're getting off there or you're transferring west, you're the one that could be negatively impacted here. We need to look at what kind of alternative services we might be able to provide, particularly in some direct bus routes, that would make a good option for people. We've already found that with some of our direct routes downtown, like the 16Y and the 3Y, 16Y is a direct line downtown. People take that rather than take the train. They ask for more of it. I have a petition I got this week from riders on the 3Y asking for more 3Y service. There's a lot of people out there who are, in fact, happy to ride a bus that gives them a direct route rather than get on a train. And so if we can look at some of those alternatives, we can also address some of the capacity and perhaps provide a better alternative for those who would not be benefited by whatever change we wind up with. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Who would do that?
Where would the yellow line go to under this proposal?
This is peak hour only, so under this proposal, the yellow line would still turn around at Mount Vernon.
Except that your new line could just as easily be called the yellow line.
It could be called the yellow line, and you would have that direct service through there.
And given that kind of confusion, I would hope that not only will you focus on passengers on the blue line, which is where you want to do your interviews, but you would also look at people, for instance, and on the orange line at Vienna, on the blue line at Largo, on the green line at Greenbelt, because those are people who are going to now be faced with trains that start there and go different places for the first time. So are we dealing with different colors? If so, what kinds of things? How do we communicate to our passengers to not confuse them even more than they're going to be confused? And as you know, this was, in fact, attempted once before, and there was a great deal of concern by the passengers when this was attempted once before.
Yes.
And it was attempted by Dick Page, where the trains going one direction had one color, and going the other direction they had another color.
What year was that?
1982, something like that.
I guess, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to make sure, and what I hear you saying, Mr. Hughes, and I hear Mr. Zimmerman as well, Mr. Chairman as well, is that I just wanted to make sure, because I know in Prince George's County, where we have all these metro stations and we're trying desperately to get to transit-oriented development if we get our guidelines done, that when that development comes along the blue line, that you are in no way, we will be in no way reducing or limiting or further limiting any capacity there in Prince George's County.
No, we won't. Nothing. We still have the capability of expanding that capacity by a third out there just because of the length of the train.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure I'm hearing you both correctly. Okay.
Any other questions?
Thank you. Please do conduct your interviews and come back and tell us how you're going to solve all these problems. Thank you. Briefing on bus operator assaults. Mr. Story. This is an issue that board members wanted to get some additional information on.
Good morning. Milo Victoria, Assistant General Manager over Bus Service, and with me is Captain Mark Olson from our own Metro Transit Police. And again, thank you for the opportunity. We're bringing this to you at your request. This is the overview of what is happening in regards to the operator assaults. As you can see, we had 84 in the calendar year 2007, and there's the breakdown. You can see that they are on the rise. You can go back to 2002, and they kind of evened out in between 2006 and 2007 at 83 2006 and 84 in 2007. In those past 6 years that we're showing there, we have lost about 8,000 plus days productivity, and it's cost the agency over $4 million in lost productivity and medical. The breakdown of the different types, you can see that the largest portion is physical contact, and that can include anything from inappropriate touching to slapping, hitting with a closed fist, seconded by the very demeaning act of spitting on our operators. And you can see the small portion, the 2%, that 7% is where the weapons were displayed. The interesting part is that about 40% of the assailants are arrested, end up being arrested, except for the ones that that commit the assault by displaying some kind of a weapon. This here is the service area, and it shows the concentration of all the assaults in the last year. If we can go to the next slide, there's a breakdown of where in the District of Columbia they took place, and then also in Montgomery County, and then the next one, Prince George's. Each of the little buses shows an actual assault, and then the ones in Virginia. And then these are some of the initiatives that are currently taking place. We're pretty excited about the high-intensity targeted enforcement that our own transit police is conducting. They have been conducting it for a while, but in the recent past, in the last month or so, they have really stepped it up to a point where it's weekly and biweekly. And Captain Olson can explain a little bit about what that is.
Good morning. What this initiative is we utilize both plainclothes officers from our Metroplus Enforcement Division and uniformed patrol officers to, if you will, flood a bus route. The bus routes are designated by our the supervisor of our Metro Bus Division and Mr. Petricelli of bus. Working in conjunction, they designate certain routes which we're having problems on. We will utilize these officers to patrol these routes, make contact with operators, customers, and the neighborhood community. It's been very successful. We've issued numerous citations, made numerous arrests, and obviously had had very good public reaction to this initiative. We started it in 2005, did it on a monthly basis at that time. Now we're doing it on a weekly basis. Thank you.
Do you want to speak about the other 2 points? Communication with
All right, the other 2 points, the improved communication between the bus operators and our officers. We have two things going on there. One of them is our Metro Bus Enforcement personnel are assigned specific bus divisions that they're responsible to attend the safety meetings at. During those safety meetings, they're briefed on problems that the operators are experiencing on the routes. Secondly, is our patrol officers are directed to, while on patrol, meet up with bus operators, contact them, and fill out a card, which we call an operator contract card, to document their contact with the operators. Both these initiatives do give us the opportunity to find out where the operators are experiencing problems. They're our eyes and ears out there, if you will. There's a lot more of the operators than there are of the police, and we gladly accept their comments and try to address their problems as quickly as possible.
Mr. Chairman,
they're not finished.
Okay, the last bullet on the ongoing initiatives is the DC legislation bill 17233, which several members of the Local 689, as well as Transit Police and myself, submitted testimony to the DC Council to increase the penalties for assaulting our bus operators. And we are waiting on the conclusion of that. Future initiatives, you can see a picture on the right side. This is one of our own buses that we designed and installed a shield to protect the operator. We will be doing the same to 5 more buses, and then we'll send them out to the different runs to get input from the operators as well as our general public on how effective that'll be. Several other agencies are doing the same thing as well. And then next, Transit Police will be increase the staffing as the vacancies increase. And that concludes our presentation.
I have 2 points and then pass it on to some other people. One is I did want to make sure that you were aware that there's legislation in Maryland as well before our legislature right now, which increases the penalties not only for attacks on bus operators but also on passengers. So that's something else that's worth tracking and perhaps supporting. And the other one is just my reaction to the shield is, yes, we have to protect our bus operators. I think that's very important. I think there's a balance there that we have to think about as we do it, and that is one of the very attractive things about many of our operators is that they're very positive. They interact with the passengers very well. It's a nice thing to get on a bus and have the bus operator recognize you and say hello and talk to you for a few seconds as you're getting on or off, and that's something that gets impeded as you put a shield between the operator and the passenger.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Giancola, you had a...
Yeah, I thank you for the report. Of course, it is very troubling to have that trend going up. And what I'd like to ask, I assume you're tracking the time of day some of these are occurring, and is there a trend of certain times of the day that these kinds of attacks are occurring?
There is actually, it is mostly during the week, and the highest points are between 2 and 4 in the afternoon and 6 and 8 in the evening.
Yeah, and the second question is, I'm assuming when the bus operator is under attack or being approached, he calls dispatch, and dispatch then sends out our Metro Police. If that's the case, do we also send out a report or a 911 call to the local jurisdiction's police force as well, or do we just rely on our own police force? Because I want to, you know, sometimes our person may not be the closest person to the scene.
Yes, sir. When OCC does receive an emergency call, our police department is dispatched as well as the local police agency.
So they do dispatch, or they make calls to both
our
and the other agency?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Thank you very much. I'm the author of the legislative bill 17-233 and the council of the district funder, and we are pressing to have this legislation enacted. And so I very much appreciate the concern that's being expressed here. I have two questions. Number one, I just want to understand a little bit better what physical contact is.
Yes.
You said brushing up against someone?
Actually, it's more than that. If an operator may be inappropriately touched. As an example, we had one about 2 weeks ago where a female operator had her leg appropriately touched. Sexual assaults are, we consider those a lot. We've had incidents, for example, where an operator was half undressed, attacked and half undressed by a...
so that's more serious.
Yes, more serious.
Well, I think that, you clearly have a trend here. I mean, I'm looking at 2002 to 2007. There's an unmistakable trend. And, of course, it's a great concern to us that very nearly two-thirds of all of this is happening in the District of Columbia, which is very, very troubling. But I'd like to have, Mr. Cato, I would like to have a little bit better definition of a physical contact. Because, I'm not diminishing in any way the seriousness of this, but we are putting out information that these are operator assaults.
And so.
Now, I said earlier in this meeting that I'm an attorney, but I am an attorney. Yeah. And an assault means something. And I want to be reassured that these 44% are legally classified as assaults. Okay. Can you reassure me, Captain?
Yes, sir. An assault by code is an unlawful touching.
Of any kind?
Yes, sir.
By the way,
the
trend is also up for passenger assaults as well.
So maybe you could tell me the number of people within the 44% that were arrested.
We can find that information. I don't know if you have it with you today.
No, sir, I don't.
We can
That might help me understand what's going on here. So within the 44% physical contact, that's your term, not mine, how many of these people were actually arrested? The second issue that concerns me here, or rather that's of interest to me, is the plainclothes officers. How many plainclothes officers have you committed to this work?
Currently, sir, we have 12 officers and one supervisor assigned to the Metro Bus Enforcement Division.
As plainclothes?
Yes, sir. The highest the Metro Bus Enforcement Division, highest number of personnel that ever, has ever been assigned there was 20, and we are working towards reestablishing that number over there. We're currently in the process of doing a resource allocation study, and we're not through with that, so I can't speak very well on it. But our intent is to staff up the Metro Bus Enforcement Division.
And just related to that, how many plainclothes officers do you have on in the subway cars?
Well, that varies from day to day, sir, depending upon our patrol schedule. And if our uniform beats are actually covered, then we're able to utilize our patrol officers in a casual clothes status, but they patrol both the buses and the rail at that time.
Well, can you give me any idea at all? Because there, too, this is not directly related to this information, but there, too, we have seen a trend of increase in terms of the number of assaults within our rail cars and on our in our stations. Most recently, I've been involved in one of these cases quite considerably. And the aggrieved mother would be very interested in knowing, as am I, just what kind of commitment we're making in terms of plainclothes presence on our rail cars and stations. No numbers at all, Mr. Cato?
I have no numbers off the top of my head. We will provide those.
Why would you have numbers on buses? I mean, you precisely, you have 12 officers in plainclothes with a supervisor, and you have no number at all for me on rail cars?
Oh, no, sir. I can answer that. Currently, we have an 8-member casual clothes team that are assigned to the rails.
Okay, that's right. So it's 12 on buses, 8 on rail cars.
Yes, sir. Currently, yes.
Okay, that's specific. Thank you.
Mr. Monomy. No? Mr. Zimmerman.
Thank you. I mean, this was brought to us at the request of board members. Obviously, the manager has been keeping us updated on this on a regular basis, and board members were seeing, and week after week, really, what I think was to us fairly startling results. I'm pleased to see that there's an effort being made to see what we can do about this, because clearly this is not an acceptable situation. And I'm very interested in your exploring all the things you are to try and change this environment. I want to echo the caution I heard some people voice about the idea of a shield or a screen. I think that there are a number of issues with that, one of which would be safety to the driver in some circumstances in which being confined might not be a good thing. Another of which is, as was said, the question of communications with the passengers. And I wonder about the overall safety environment, because there is the other part of this too, which is the risk to passengers on the bus from these kind of incidents. So I would hope that we look at things that don't basically create new barriers between us and the passengers. At the same time, if you're going to wind up trying something, there was mention about soliciting feedback from customers as well. And the question is, how are you going to get feedback from customers about this or anything else? How would they know? If I'm on a bus and I see it and I have an opinion one way or the other, how would I know to do anything?
Right. We're working on that. We have not put that bus out yet, and what we'll probably do is have some kind of a comment card turned in to the operator.
Is there going to be a sign up, with a phone number or an email address or something that says,
we can do that as well.
Visibly? And I think you need something like that. I also think if we talk to experts from the outside about what creates a secure environment, I wonder if they're going to, the emphasis in recent years has been eyes on the street, defensible space, not creating a fortress-like environment, because that tends not to make for a safer place. And our folks are all going to be on the other side of the shield. So, I hope we will focus on what things we do to ensure that a bus is a safe place for everybody, which is, what I think it needs to be. Thanks.
Thank you.
Mr. McKay.
The incidents that are occurring, predominant amount, are weekdays between 2 and 4. Are they also involving minors?
Are they also involving
minors predominantly? Are these kids getting off of school, essentially?
A lot of our, I don't have an exact number, but a lot of the assaults do include the younger crowds.
And what communication are we having with the school system about what's happening and what the consequences to the students are?
Transportation is working.
We have two sergeants that are designated as our youth services coordinators. They speak on a daily basis with the D.C. public schools on a conference call. With that, we're able to designate special details to assist in any juvenile disorder that does happen in the system. Now, that includes being at the bus transfer station, such as Minnesota Avenue or Anacostia, and having a large presence of uniformed personnel there.
And I guess the question for Mr. Graham, does your Bill 17-233 apply to minors too?
Mr. Graham?
I'd have to check that. That's an interesting question. Do you know offhand?
I believe it is that for any assault. For
any assault, okay.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions? If not, after 1 hour and 45 minutes, let me refer you to the subsequent agenda, and unless there are any objections, declare this meeting adjourned. And we'll move on. 5-minute break and go to finance.